So when you look at those 2 years, are there particular, you know, and if you were talking to a colleague from another state or a city that wants to do this, what are the major ingredients that make this work, and what are the things that will not make it work?
I'll start because Tony's been doing such an incredible job talking about this work. And I think it's perfect for a quality improvement forum to talk about this, because most of what you might imagine are facilitators and barriers are the same kinds of things that you all are experiencing doing your quality improvement work. So the facilitators that we've seen for these changes across hospitals and health systems are having the buy-in of leadership, right? Because often the leadership team is setting the priorities, and some people might look at this and say, like, what? I don't understand it. That's not a priority. You're not going to work on that, right? But having leadership buy-in and leadership that understand the connection between racial justice and health equity is super central, and that's also described in our inaugural report and is something that every member of the coalition has said. Another is actually engagement of trainees. Trainees and students all across the country have been a huge driving force in these changes, and they've been demanding that their institutions make these changes as well. That's been a huge part of the fuel for the fire as well. And then I think the final one I'll mention is just the professional societies. A facilitator is when the professional societies say that the standards change, everyone starts to fall into line and think, oh, I guess this is a practice that we should reconsider or a change that we should make. Barriers are the usual things, right? It's not high enough on the priority list, difficulties getting electronic medical record teams and IT to kind of be involved in some of the changes is often a barrier. And then just, again, as Tony already referenced, safety net hospitals, many of them don't necessarily have the research assistants or evaluation staff or other project management staff that might focus on this very complex systems change issue. And so that's been a big part of what we've been trying to do, is to support safety net hospitals in particular, who serve more people of color, Black and Latinx people specifically, who are mentioned in all of these algorithms, except the kitty one. So that has also been a huge part of our approach, is trying to support safety net hospitals to do this.
So based on that, the algorithms now are proliferating. Health systems are actually contracting with outside organizations to develop their algorithms. So how does that impact, like if you're a health system, how do you know that the algorithm that you have from whatever company that you passed, that sounds to me like a real barrier. And we had John Blunt, who is at Mayo, and he talked about artificial intelligence and started to talk about a lot of these biases in imaging.
I would love to hear Tony's thoughts, but I wanted to jump in on the last question, because the question of how the algorithms are generated is so central to this. And often what happens is it's observational data and a regression analysis looking at the statistical pattern, but usually the regression analysis and the data that are being looked at underrepresent or poorly represent communities of color, and are often not also collected with social needs, social determinants of health. So what then happens is you see this pattern where most of the Black patients, for example, have worse blood pressure control than everyone else, and people start to think that there's some biological issue or there's some physiological issue. It all goes back to your understanding and your health system's understanding of what race is and is not. In fact, I usually start my talks with W.B. Du Bois. Philadelphia. The Philadelphia Negro published in 1899, where his whole entire thesis was trying to prove that the differences in health outcomes for Black people in Philadelphia were different and worse than white people, not for any biological reason, but because of the social conditions. And now we're 125 years later having the same conversation. And so when people see those patterns in these large databases, they often will attribute it to biology. Instead of actually saying, oh, actually we didn't look at housing, education, wealth, income, all of these other factors that often account for the large majority of the difference between what you might see for Black and white, just using the Black-white case, Black and white health outcomes. And so then if your algorithm is considering race a biological issue rather than looking at some of these social factors, again, by race, you end up with the wrong solutions. And a lot of the algorithms are not, or the people creating the algorithms are misusing race. What we're saying is race has to be rigorously collected, evaluated, tracked. All of your outcomes should be looked at by race ethnicity. We are not saying that therefore black people are somehow inherently different or, you know, in W.E.B. Du Bois' day, inherently inferior. So that's what he was trying to disprove. It's actually what you need to do is after you see that pattern, which many of you are probably seeing, you have to understand, well, what is actually causing it? It is not biology. So what are the social factors and other factors that might be leading to that pattern? So I say all that to say, unless the people developing the algorithms truly understand what happens when you look at data about race ethnicity and what the pattern is that you're seeing and understand what queries and what questions to integrate into their regression analysis, we're going to end up with the same problem that Tony just presented. So, thank you.
You talked about patient engagement, and so can you say more about how, you know, how do you define patient engagement for this type of work?
Yeah, well, they should know. They should know.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And so I think that's the thing, is that we're not. I think our culture in medicine is very much like, you know, kind of hide the mistake. Don't acknowledge harm, right? And I think that that's wrong. You know, I think we all think that. Those of us in this work, you think that that's wrong. And what we have to do is just say, hey, we messed up. This hurt. Sorry. You know? And start the conversation from there and say, okay, now that we know better, how can we actually facilitate you getting the access to services that you've been denied all this time? And so the first way to engage the patient. Just take accountability and to accept that we made a mistake and that it was wrong and wasn't based on anything that was scientific, right? You know, science is always changing, it's always evolving. I think that's something, you know, part of my podcast is that we talk about is that, like, you know, we for those of you who went to medical school, you know, my first day, the anatomy teacher was like, everything I'm going to tell you now is going to be different advice, you know? That's medicine, right? That's why you have to do continuing education. You know, what we knew yesterday might not be true tomorrow. But once you know, then you need to like let folks know what you know and what happened because you didn't know, and then you can take it forward. So, for example, the National Kidney Foundation is one of our incredible collaborative partners, and they worked with us on figuring out how do we engage patients around the fact that their kidney diagnosis has been wrong all this time. And so we talked about it, right? We did a campaign, we did a full campaign about it, we gave materials about it, we did social media posts about it, we did webinars about it, we did a question and answer online about it. All the materials we reviewed, we made sure structural racism was put into the language to call it out and not hide it, so folks can decide to go to the doctor, right? We've really, you know, with the patient engagement question is a fascinating one because we've really built a circle of distrust with our patients. And so that's going to take time and investment, not only from us as, you know, the professionals, to take investments and resources to try to gain that trust back. And so just acknowledging that and being patient with the folks and being, you know, consistent in your messaging, right? Not just doing it during Black History Month, but doing it all year round, right? And trying to make improvements, that's how you can engage the patient in the conversation.
I couldn't agree more, and I just want to add one more thing since you all are quality improvement leaders, like you're familiar, of course, with patient safety and the culture of safety and how difficult it is for us in the medical profession or how challenging we find it to really be honest when a mistake happens. And I think applying those same principles to this work is fact, we need more folks with QI expertise to like bring guidelines, recommendations, you know, tools and new kinds of algorithms on how to do that better. I think there's a lot to learn from the patient safety movement on how we address harm as, you know, we talk about these algorithms. And specifically, the other thing I was gonna mention is we are now seeing Black patients be told, because of the changes in transplant accrual time, that they actually have an additional several years accrued on the transplant waiting list, and that they're going to get a kidney. So they were systematically disadvantaged, where years were not added to their transplant wait time because of this algorithm, and now they're getting that time back. And that, to me, ultimately, those are the stories that Black patients need to hear as well.
You also were, I think in your last report, you talked about also eliminating chronic kidney disease or the disparities in chronic kidney disease. So I'm curious, because we're all here as quality improvement folks, if you were to develop a new collaborative, how do you identify, like, the priorities to focus on? Is it diabetes? Is it, you know, motor vehicle accidents? Is it, you know, so how did you go about, you know, going from all of these algorithms to EGFR, hypertension, and to CKD? And how could others, you know, contribute to build on that?
Yeah. I can start and then Michelle can take over. I think that for EGFR was relatively easy because the academic societies that govern nephrology came out and already said that, like, after years of advocacy, it had been like 10 years or so of advocacy in this space, they finally came out and said that, you know, race adjustment is wrong, we should use a different equation. And having that support of the academic professional societies helped propel the changes that we saw across the institutions that we worked with. So that was with EGFR. Like, that was one that was like, hey, here's an easy one, because we have buy-in from the top, right? Then with VVAC, the same thing. The obstetric societies had already made a statement about taking out race adjustment. Wasn't as far along as EGFR, but that was a good starting point. Now with PFTs, that was an interesting one because of the fact that ATS had not actually made any statements. And so this was an opportunity to see, can the coalition mechanism actually get the academic society to actually say something? And so it was particularly relevant because of the COVID pandemic and all of the inequities that we saw with COVID, and now you're using, you know, now there's chronic lung disease, and now you're using spirometry, which also, the inequity, it's just inequity on top of inequity on top of inequity with that one in particular, and so those are the reasons why we chose those three particular algorithms. There's a plethora to choose from, but that's the reason why, because as far as I understand.
Yeah. Yes, and we were also thinking, like, which algorithms touch the most patients possible. Yeah. Some of them are, like, kind of more narrow. There's some There's like a pediatrics one about UTI risk factors, right? And it's not to say it's not important, but it is a much more kind of narrow group of patients. So wanting all, knowing that, like, EGFR, and you can't leave a hospital without getting your kidney function checked, right? And very similar lung issues, COVID and beyond, are massive and so common. And so also wanting to kind of have a population level.
Question about choices between dialysis and transplantation. Are you going to address this?
More to come.
Okay.
Next two years. Yeah, more to come on that. We're working on looking at that actual question. So, more to come.
And I have one last question, and then we'll open it up. You both have done, you know, work globally, and reflections on that work and what lessons you brought to this work because there's always a tendency to say, well, I'm not invented here, yet, yes, I'd like to hear you, you know, talk about what you brought.
I think I will say, I usually, when I give my global health talk, I actually start with that. I think that my biggest shock, I spent most of my time working in Haiti when I came out of residency, and working in areas where there was, you know, the urban areas, a lot of high poverty, and that was just kind of where I wanted to be, kind of understand those systems. And my work in Haiti, I think I was more like forgiving, to be honest, because I was like, you know, this country, you know, the historical, you know, inequities that have happened to Haiti and all the things that have happened, like how could they have a better functioning health system? I was kind of going about it in that way. And, you know, again, trying to find the solutions with limited resources. Mm-hmm. I learned how to do that by working in Haiti and working with the magnificent clinicians that are in Haiti that are, you know, making a dollar out of 15 cents, literally, to really save the lives of their patients, right? So I learned that from them. And I think when I started working more on the U.S. side, I was more shocked, honestly. I was like, wow, because I had been, I was like head down in my work in Haiti, because I was like, the U.S. can't be this bad, right? And then I came to like more working in New York, and I was like, oh my God, people with insurance. Like in my work in Miami, I worked in a safety net hospital where nobody got insurance. They were on like sliding scale cards or something like that. They were underinsured, undocumented, you know, folks dying at the door, right? When I came back to New York, and I'm from Queens, Hunter College, I'm from Queens. I was like, oh, it's not, you know, NYU and Cornell, it's gonna be amazing here. And then I came and I worked in Brooklyn, and I was like, people are dying at the door and they have insurance. Like, this is crazy. I have to say that's what I brought to it, is to my work in New York, is that like, wow. That like, when you have limited resources or you're being obstructed from receiving resources, the outcomes are the same. And it doesn't matter where you are geographically.
I mean, I don't have too much to add to that, I will say. but I think one thing I'll mention just really briefly is I worked with an organization called Partners in Health for many, many years, and was deputy chief medical officer there, and worked quite a bit in rural Haiti and rural Rwanda. And a lot of what I saw was the power of proximity and community health workers, and specifically community health workers. First assignment when I went to Rwanda in 2009 was essentially to follow a community health worker around for many, many weeks and just learn what they were doing, whether it was, you know, directly observed therapy or, you know, making the connection to the local primary care clinic or helping, you know, a family get food assistance. Or, I mean, they're multi-purpose community health workers in Rwanda, very similar in Haiti. And that proximity and that connection, and particularly the community health workers being from the communities where the patients are, or in the examples in Haiti, often were HIV positive themselves or were cured of tuberculosis, or themselves, the community health workers were people who had gone through what the patients that they were serving had been through. And it is absolutely transformative. And it's really sad to me that more people in the U.S. don't have access to community health workers. But it's just one of those incredible game changer interventions.